The next case was presented to Dr. Grothy by Dr. Malik Safa.
This is a 60-year-old woman who presented in 2003 with a blood per rectum. She had underwent a colonoscopy and she had a mid-rectal lesion. At the same time, she had CT scan showed multiple liver and lung lesions.
And what was her condition at that point? Any symptoms?
She had only the blood per rectum. She was having no weight loss, no other symptoms, liver or lung related.
What was her life situation in terms of work and
she
family?
Works as a waitress, so she was a full-time worker, and she was in good shape otherwise. She had no other past medical history at all.
Spouse and kids?
She lived alone, and she had two kids.
How old were the kids, do you know?
35 and 45.
What was her emotional reaction to being diagnosed with metastatic rectal cancer?
She was surprised because she had a normal health lifestyle. She was surprised that she had no family history of cancer and she was not a smoker or anything. So she was surprised that she was diagnosed with colon cancer.
How would you in general, Axel, be thinking through this initial situation of rectal cancer presenting with metastatic disease?
First of all, it's interesting. This is something that you hear a lot. Even patients that present with metastatic disease and colorectal cancer are largely asymptomatic, so it could be a surprise finding. I mean, some patients have blood per rectum, probably one of the symptoms that she could have had, but they're rarely symptomatic from their metastasis. So this is a surprise finding. And this is actually something we have to keep in mind because it's a very different situation than, let's say, a patient with non-small cell lung cancer who come in who are normally sick, pre-existing lung disease, whatever, pancreatic cancer. Patients have pain. So colorectal cancer patients, even in a metastatic situation, are largely asymptomatic. And if we're in a palliative situation, we should kind of do whatever we can to maintain their quality of life. Because initially when they come to us, their quality of life is still good because they are asymptomatic. She probably worked full time. She probably had nothing else to complain about.
So we actually, this is a little bit similar to Steve's case, but anyhow, why don't you bring us up to the present?
So she was treated at that time with FOLFOX chemotherapy for 6 months, and she had complete resolution of her liver and lung lesion. And at that time, she had repeated lower endoscopy, which showed also no mass at all in her rectum, and it could not be found.
How did she tolerate the therapy?
She did very well. She had only mild neuropathy, mainly grade 1, and she had no other problems.
So she had no clinical evidence of tumor?
No.
Okay.
At that time, she wanted to stop chemotherapy because she was working. She didn't want to get any maintenance therapy or anything. At that time, there was no data about maintenance therapy or Optimax data. So we stopped chemotherapy completely for 7 months. And then repeated CT scan showed progressive disease again in the liver and lungs.
Anything in the area of the primary?
At that time, she had no symptoms or blood per rectum or her CBC was stable.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, first of all, this is very much what I like to hear about the primary tumor responding to therapy. And this is this notion primary tumors don't respond as well. I mean, we have seen PCRs on chemotherapy, and I'm glad you also mentioned there's no biologic involved. Chemotherapy alone can be very effective. Nowadays, we tend to think that treatment for colorectal cancer started with the introduction of bevacizumab, which is not true. We had good treatment even before that, as soon as irinotecan and oxaliplatin came around. I do think it's one of those situations where you have no tumor, you stop therapy, and you probably knew it's going to come back. Yeah.
This was, I guess, 2003, so kind of pre-bevacizumab days.
Yep.
But can you comment a little bit on the issue of treatment holidays that you've done so much research with and what you think about what happened here?
Since 2003, I think our concept of palliative therapy and how to deal with these issues, maintenance therapy, break from oxaliplatin, has a little bit further evolved. I mean, we have recognized the dose-limiting toxicity of oxaliplatin is neurotoxicity. We probably should not, in a palliative situation, treat patients too long so that they don't have too much neurotoxicity. I haven't mentioned yet whether she had kind of cumulative neurotoxicity here. But after 6 months of FOLFOX, almost everyone has some form of neurotoxicity. Since then, I mean, with the introduction of bevacizumab, data from the Optimax 2 trial, which shows there's probably some irrational to have some maintenance therapy around, kind of chemo light, as John Marshall likes to call it. One of the approaches that I normally do in my clinical practice is starting with FOLFOX bevacizumab, for instance, in a palliative situation, stopping oxaliplatin routinely after 4 months of therapy, and then continue with a fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab if patients tolerate it.
So you want to bring us up to date?
Yeah, so at that time, because of her great response and Avastin was on board, at that time decided to treat her again with FOLFOX and Avastin. Actually, she took her first cycle very well. During her second dose, after the oxaliplatin, within half an hour, she developed fever and petechial rash all over her upper and lower extremities. and CBC was repeated at that time, and her platelet count was 5,000 after the oxaliplatin infusion. So she was admitted to the hospital. She was given platelet transfusion. We tested for IgG antiplatelet antibodies and were positive. And her platelet count improved gradually over 1 to 2 days. And then because of that reaction, we changed her to FOLFIRI plus Avastin, and she did well without further problem. At that time, she continued FOLFIRI Avastin for many months, and she had a good control of her disease. And then finally, she progressed for the last couple of years, and she has been through multiple agents, including cetuximab, panitumumab, and recently on other therapy.
So what's her current situation?
At this time, finally, I mean, because she was not interested in going anywhere for a clinical trial, I put her 6 months ago when her CA went up to 3,000 on mitomycin with Xeloda. And she had significant improvement. Her CA dropped down to like 50 after like 4 cycles. And I maintained her on Xeloda only, and she's having now stable disease.
So she's had metastatic disease for 5 years?
5 years now.
Has she been working most of that time?
Now she's part-time. She's still working, but part-time.
Let's go back to what happened there with the oxaliplatin in terms of the thrombocytopenia.
Yeah, I mean, there are several reasons why you can have thrombocytopenia on oxaliplatin therapy. The reason in the context that you kind of mentioned with the rapid drop of thrombocytes suggests some immunologic phenomenon like antibody-mediated, some kind of an ITP-like reaction, something that got triggered by whatever apparently was oxaliplatin and not the other components, because FOLFIRI Avastin was tolerated well. So the other reasons to have platelets drop on oxaliplatin is you have the bolus 5-FU component, FOLFOX and elotafol, which I don't use personally in a palliative setting. I never use bolus 5-FU, and as soon as you delete bolus 5-FU, your myelosuppression kind of gets in the low single-digit ranges in grade 3-4 toxicity. You have the phenomenon, you've probably seen that, the longer you treat a patient with oxaliplatin-based therapy, the larger the spleen grows. It's kind of a sinusoidal dilatation, liver architecture injury, more or less, that we have with prolonged duration of therapy with oxaliplatin. There's actually a poster at ASCO about this year, correlating the spleen size and thrombocytopenia on oxaliplatin-based therapy. But it's not as dramatic as you've mentioned, which is clearly an immunologic phenomenon. And we know that oxaliplatin hypersensitivity reactions are not uncommon. It's in the range of about 8 to 10%. And it's one of the more common reactions that we see at Mayo Clinic, for instance, where the rate of cetuximab-induced reaction is very low. We're not in this tobacco belt where the rate is high. So our nurses are quite aware of the fact that oxaliplatin can cause these hypersensitivity reactions. One comment to the mitomycin and capecitabine. There's actually a study, a phase 3 study ongoing in Australia right now, the so-called MAX trial, which tests mitomycin, Avastin, and Xeloda. That's why MAX in a first-line setting, because mitomycin, capecitabine is actually something that's very popular in, let's say, environments where financial constraints are even larger than here, because it's cheap, mitomycin.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the issue in terms of phase 1-2 trials available to these patients and where that fits in. She said she's not interested, but if she were, Axel, what are some of the agents that are being looked at right now that you think? I mean, obviously, patients are looking for the possibility. If I'm a patient looking out there right now of something different, you know, biologic, some kind of new thing that maybe they could look out on, what's out there right now?
I mean, what's out there right now is anything along the lines of IGF receptor inhibitors, c-MET HGF receptor inhibitor. There are MEK inhibitors, MEK inhibitors, which are being tested. There are drugs we know, like sorafenib, for instance, which has some RAS-RAF inhibitory component. And Apotrail, actually very interesting, with some data in colorectal cancer already, which is an activator of the death receptor. So the kind of activates the apoptosis cascade in tumor cells.
But, you know, all these things are, when oncologists in practice in general, I think they're just like names. They don't know how to differentiate. Is there anything that's been seen that's exciting with any of these things?
I think if I had to put my money down right now on what's the next drug in colorectal cancer? I think Apotrail, the death toll receptor, is interesting because I've seen data of patients with single agent activity responding in colorectal cancer to this drug.
What's it called?
Apotrail, APO-trail. And there are actually two different drugs. One is a peptibody and a kind of a peptide activation. One is an antibody that's probably a little bit more It's actually co-marketed, interestingly, by Amgen and Genentech, one of the drugs, Apotril, and the other drug is
What's
Genentech.
Been seen in terms of side effects, toxicity, any response information?
You know, the response information right now is on the phase 1/2. You see patient had gone through all the treatments and got this Apotril activator, and you see a response. I mean, the response is pretty impressive.
Objective response to single-agent therapy.
Yes. So there are response to single-agent therapy.
We're actually doing a study with folfoxavastatin with or without that, along with the
serotonin. So it's in the phase 3 setting.
It's in a phase 2 setting right now.
Yeah, randomized phase 2.
Yeah.
Have you treated any patients with that
No,
study?
It's just opening.
Interesting. You mentioned sorafenib. What do we know about sorafenib, or for that matter, sunitinib in colon cancer?
Yeah. Sorafenib and sunitinib look like the same drug, but they're not the same drug. I mean, we clearly know, I mean, those of us who treat renal cell cancer, we use both drugs, but they have different toxicity profiles. I think sorafenib is an interesting drug from the KRAS perspective. KRAS has made this huge inroads into colon cancer and the way we think, and also the way we design clinical trials. Because now we have a group of patients which lost one treatment option, cetuximab, the 40% of patients that have KRAS mutated tumors. And actually, they never had the treatment option, but we didn't know. Now we identify this patient population. These patients lose their treatment with EGF receptor inhibitors. So cetuximab, panitumumab won't apply to these patients. So you're using your FOLFOX bevacizumab first line or FOLFIRI bevacizumab. You have one more line, and then you're done. So in some ways, this group of patients opens the door for new drug development because they are in need of drug. Because pharmaceutical companies for a long time have asked us, so how can we get the next new drug in colon cancer? It's such a crowded field. You go through all these lines of therapy and hardly ever anyone wants to use a drug in a last line setting to show proof of efficacy. So now there's actually a coordinated intergroup approach led by Neil Maripol, Dan Sargent, and myself to develop strategies, clinical trial strategies between these different cooperative groups to target patients with mutant KRAS tumors and have rapidly circulating phase 2 trials, randomized phase 2 trials with the same control arm so that after, let's say, 2 years, and we're offering this to companies, say, okay, you can test your drug in first-line setting in these patients, which is a very attractive venue for companies.
Why first-line?
First of all, we can screen the effect of an anti-tumor agent very efficiently in first-line setting because patients haven't seen anything.
But you're saying you would do, I mean, what situations would you do that in first-line as opposed to, say, given FOLFOX-BEV?
We would use FOLFOX-BEV as our standard component added to it, similar to what we just heard, FOLFOX-BEVacizumab plus minus the drug.
So that's the way it's been positioned with FOLFOX-BEV?
With FOLFOX-BEV or FOLFIRI-BEV. So we have FOLFOX-BEV because this won't go away. We'll have bevacizumab around. And the question is, can we improve upon that?
What about sorafenib in terms of the mechanism of action? Maybe, you know, one of the things that we haven't gone through today, even though I think probably everybody here is aware of it, but just for completeness, is what actually is KRAS and what does it mean to be mutant?
So KRAS is a part of the signal transduction cascade downstream of EGF receptor, which is a membrane-bound protein which gets activated through ligand binding, and we have some ligands identified like amphiregulin, epiregulin. And downstream of this EGF receptor is a cascade, actually two major cascades, one going through RAS, RAF, MEK, and then gene transcription activation in the cell nucleus. The other one goes through the AKT pathway, which is regulated by P10 to some extent. So when we just focus on these simplified two pathways, if a downstream factor, downstream of EGF receptor, is activated, constantly activated, it just drives the whole machinery and the signal transduction regardless what happens upstream, meaning we can block EGF receptor as much as we want. If something downstream is activated, it will never be of any help. So, and this is theory, but it translates exactly into the practical situation because with an abundance of evidence now from various clinical trials, phase 3 trials, first line, last line, setting single agent EGF receptor inhibitors, combination with chemotherapy, as soon as a tumor has mutated KRAS, meaning activated KRAS, EGF receptor targeted agents don't work in colorectal cancer. And mutations can be found about 40% of patients. So it is actually quite important.
So we want to make sure we ask all three faculty today in terms of what they're doing with the KRAS wild patient first line. What are you doing?
KRAS wild type, first line, if it's a palliative situation, I will not change my standard of care. I don't use EGF receptor-targeted agent first-line therapy for these clearly palliative scenarios based on the fact that the CRYSTAL data, which compared FOLFIRI plus minus cetuximab, even in a KRAS wild type scenario, did show some increase in progression-free survival and some increase in response rate, but it's not as convincing as I would have liked it to beat bevacizumab, which is in some ways an easier drug to use. You have no stigmatizing rash, and we kind of know how to handle bevacizumab quite well. The situation might be different for a patient who has, let's say, potentially liver resectable disease, where you're shooting for a higher response rate. And the addition of cetuximab to FOLFOX, for instance, the OPUS trial, in KRAS wild-type tumors led to an increased response rate by 24%. So we're approaching, and these are confirmed responses and reviewed responses, over 60%. And this can make the difference between resectability or non-resectability. And in addition, cetuximab doesn't interfere with wound healing, liver regeneration, whatever you might think of. So I can easily envision that this is the place where cetuximab, perhaps panitumumab, we don't have enough data on that, could be part of first-line therapy with curative intent when it leads to liver resection, for instance.
One related question concerning the EGFR antibodies is the issue of infusion reaction. Can you update us on that? We had these intriguing information that looked like there was some geographic connection to that. What do we now know about that?
It's an interesting geographic connection that had actually been known for quite some time by colleagues in Nashville up to the North Carolina belt, so in the what we call tobacco region, reported about 20-25% infusion reactions to cetuximab, whereas in more colder climate, and believe me, Minnesota is colder than Nashville, the reactions are rare. When you looked at our data, it's about 2-3%, exactly in line with what we see in the literature. And recently, there was a publication, New England Journal of Medicine, about the detection of a preformed IgE antibody against a certain epitope, which can also be found not actually on the cetuximab drug, but on the, I think it's solvent, that kind of a component of this cetuximab infusion, that is in the process of drug manufacturing, so that those patients who have this antibody, they have the risk of infusion reactions. And in fact, there is hopefully going to be a commercially available test produced for us by fall this year. We will probably not need to use it because infusion reaction is so low. But for people in Tennessee, North Carolina, etc., it might be worthwhile.
Any comments on the long natural history of the disease in this woman? She has metastatic disease now for 5 years and is doing well. How often are we seeing that nowadays?
I would say it's more common than when I started getting into GI oncology about 12 years ago, because we have more drugs available to influence the disease. But on the other hand, more than anything, the biology of this tumor kind of created this good outcome, because, I mean, she had a complete response which lasted for several months on FOLFOX chemotherapy. So it's a very chemosensitive tumor. And then you played all your cards in the right way. I mean, I do believe that kind of keeping patients on and off on treatment and utilizing everything that you have in a strategic manner, and perhaps even going back to something that might have worked in the past, so you kind of recycle chemotherapies. In her situation, a little bit more complicated with the reaction to oxaliplatin. This is what keeps patients alive, mindful of quality of life, and that's why if she works full-time or part-time now, I think this is actually an ideal treatment approach that you had.
Has she ever been scoped again to see what's going on with the primary lesion?
Not since she had progressive disease, not for the first one. But she never had any more blood per rectum, so, and her CBC has been stable because she dropped her hemoglobin when she developed bleeding.
Ken?
When she relapsed, did she relapse in the same spot that she had her original disease?
You mean liver and lung?
Yeah.
Same,
so
the question,
same locations, you mean?
Same location. So the question I have...
She never had disease anywhere else.
Okay, so the question I have is, let's make a leap of faith. What about resecting disease that is, you've marked it out, and resecting the area, because we know, literature-wise, that there's going to be microscopic disease still present, take it out, and that's a chance, again, for local control, if she can tolerate it, I understand that.
In an attempt to, quote, cure her?
Yeah.
Let's just talk about the liver lesions. Are they potentially resectable?
No, she had multi-lobar and she had also both lungs.
Okay.
So she had lesions in both
lungs. All right,
and
but if it was just one area.
You're right.
There was just one area.
I agree with you completely. I mean, if you can resect, if you can obtain local control and render a patient free of disease, surgery is the way to go, or local ablative techniques later on. I mean, I understood that there was really no realistic surgical approach in this situation. Yeah.
What about going back to something, to chemo plus bevacizumab?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, and you probably went back to irinotecan at some point. And
I did.
So I have a similar case, actually, with a two-year longer history now, and we kind of constantly recycle things. We're actually coming to the point where her dose-limiting toxicity is actually myelotoxicity on irinotecan. The tumor is still sensitive to irinotecan. Whatever I throw at her, even low-dose irinotecan, the tumor responds, but her myelosuppression also kicks in. Very similar case. So, but my patient enjoys good quality of life, was in Hawaii just about last winter and did some snorkeling, et cetera, was a little bit impaired because she had ascites and she didn't like that because snorkeling and ascites really doesn't go well.
What about using panitumumab after cetuximab failure?
An interesting question. First of all, both antibodies bind exactly to the same epitope. There is really no difference in binding. This is exactly the same spot. We do see some evidence, ASCO GI, I think at ASCO 2, there were some reports on some stabilization, minor responses on panitumumab after failure of cetuximab therapy. I think this is more related to a higher relative dose that's being used with panitumumab. So when panitumumab was developed, they actually developed it because they didn't find an MTD. They developed it according to the point when all patients had skin rash. So they had the idea, okay, skin rash is predictive for response, so we'll dose it up. Similar to what happened in the cetuximab Everest trial, where the Everest trial kind of upped the dose of cetuximab. You could actually give four times more cetuximab over time. You can get away with weekly 500 milligrams if you want. This is quite a lot of cetuximab, actually double the dose. And they shifted response rates, let's say, from 15% to 30%. So I believe that, and my best guess, let's say, is that the dose response curve for panitumumab is more shifted to higher the dose that's actually being used, meaning 6 milligrams per kg that are being used every 2 weeks. It's probably equivalent to a higher cetuximab dose than what we're using in clinical practice.
So right now in your practice, off study, in what situations are you using panitumumab?
I use it right now only in patients who have not been able to tolerate cetuximab, patients who had reactions. And sometimes, actually, I remember one patient where the skin rash on cetuximab was prohibitive. And interestingly, panitumumab, she tolerated panitumumab very well. So the skin rash is a little bit different. And I've heard reports panitumumab skin rash is worse than cetuximab. So I've switched for that reason, sometimes with success. The data that we have on panitumumab in combination with chemotherapy are not as solid. If we had more data, if the PACE trial, for instance, had been positive, we'd probably all use more panitumumab. I have to also say that I use cetuximab every 2 weeks, and not weekly as package insert level. I use cetuximab at 500 milligrams per meter squared every 2 weeks. And don't give a loading dose. And this is in line with FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, all these two weekly regimens that we see.
This one other point is the issue of continuation of Bev on progression and the fact that your BRIGHT study is about to be published along with two editorials in Journal Clinical Oncology. We heard about that about a year ago at ASCO. Can you talk about, this is not going to come out till after the JCO, what's going to be in the paper and the editorials?
I don't know the editorial. I know who wrote it. It was Lee Ellis and Dan Heller, so it's quite prominent. In the paper, we are giving a little bit more background on how the bevacizumab beyond progression data were generated, because this BRIGHT study, observation study, had never been published in terms of the background, how data were collected, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we also put more emphasis on one of the analyses that was not quite, it's not easy to present it in the context of just a paper or a presentation at ASCO. One of the issues we did in order to get the bias out of the equation, now let's say what we heard, those patients who get bevacizumab do better, we actually looked at the propensity of oncologists to use or not use bevacizumab beyond progression. Among us, there might be a difference in clinical practice patterns. Some believe in using bevacizumab beyond progression, some don't believe. And so we looked at the extremes and the kind of area in between. And patients were treated in physicians' practices where bevacizumab was never used beyond progression or hardly ever used beyond progression, compared to patients who were treated by believers, physicians who routinely treat patients with bevacizumab and progression. Patients treated by believers had much better outcome than patients who were treated by non-believers. So this kind of takes the patient bias question out of the equation, because now it's a physician propensity question. Then we did several statistical analyses, eliminating all good patients, all patients that would do well anyway, from the equation, and still the effect of bevacizumab beyond progression held up significantly. And there's a lot of theoretical background behind this, why it actually makes sense to continue bevacizumab beyond progression. I could look at it from a different way. There could be some harmful effect to withdraw bevacizumab from a patient. In some ways, and we have experimental models to show that, our treatment effect becomes addicted to bevacizumab. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Just give you one example, breast cancer. You know the breast cancer data, bevacizumab, prolonged progression-free survival by 6 months. You shift from 6 to 12 months. Overall survival was 2 years for both groups. So patients who never had bevacizumab had an 18-month survival after they progressed. Patients who had bevacizumab had a 12-month survival when they progressed. So why do patients, when you stop bevacizumab, have a 6-month shorter survival than patients who never had bevacizumab? There's something we have never really thought about it from this perspective, because it's really intriguing to see, you know, you have this huge difference in PFS. There's really hardly any difference overall survival. It could be because withdrawal of bevacizumab activates tumors. Very difficult to show because we don't collect, and this is the problem with our studies that we're doing, we collect data on this segment of therapy, and then we kind of leave it out there.
The PI of that, Kathy Miller has brought that up and brought up this question, a quote, VEGF rebound.
VEGF rebound. There are animal models to show that. But it's profound that it would be a very profound effect if you can really shorten survival by 6 months when you withdraw VEGF inhibition.
You know, it's interesting. We try not to talk too much about the issue of cost and reimbursement because it's just such a huge issue that we're kind of trying to stick more to research issues. But there are a couple agents out there. I think Bev's one. I think nab-paclitaxel and breast cancer is one where if you ask people, okay, let's just take away the financial issues here. Let's say it was, you know, extremely inexpensive. How would that change the way you approach it?
Yeah. I think we all recognize that for the vast majority of patients, bevacizumab is not very toxic. I mean, we have those outliers, those catastrophic events like GI perforation, ATEs, and all these things, but it's not very common. And, you know, there are not a lot of drugs in oncology where you can actually run placebo-controlled trials. You can never run a placebo-controlled trial against cetuximab, but you can do it against bevacizumab because patients don't really know what they receive. And this is something we've acknowledged and we've gotten used to handling hypertension, which is the most common side effects that I see. I think we all kind of obey these rules. You shouldn't start before 4 weeks after major surgery, and you stop it before elective surgery. We don't care about portacath implantation because it doesn't interfere with, it's not a complication that we would ever see on bevacizumab or hardly ever see on bevacizumab. So I think people would use it much more if it was cheaper. And I acknowledge very much so that if the time comes and they say we put a bevacizumab nebulizer in our oncology waiting room so that every patient gets their bevacizumab, I mean, this has financial implications that need to be addressed by society in general.
And I think, Bill, when you sent your case in, you were referring to the New York Times article about the cost of bevacizumab. I'm sure everybody here saw, and I was curious how you all felt about that, Bill.
I think it makes you cautious about it. I think the publicity of bevacizumab really does sometimes make oncologists reluctant to use it. I know in our group sometimes I had oncologists who were not using it, even though it was compendium improved. I had not restricted it, but they're just so careful about it that they were almost over-restricting it. But another comment I wanted to make, I think also with bevacizumab, if you don't have a complication early on, it's not the kind of drug, maybe with the exception, I've seen one case with a posterior leukoencephalopathy, but it's not usually a drug that people get toxicity 3, 6, 9 months later. If it's going to occur, usually it's earlier.
Correct. This is one of the kind of findings of these registries we talked about. What's the use of these registries? But if you can follow a patient through various lines of treatment for 3 years, you actually see the pattern of side effects, for instance. And I agree with you, most of these catastrophic side effects occur either early or never, and early being the first half year, 3 to 6 months.
And when you first started presenting data from the BRIGHT Registry, there was a lot of, I heard, grumbling about, hey, this is registry data, not as good as prospective data, et cetera. And then as the time kind of wound on, and now it's getting published in the JCO, people kind of started to look at it differently. Where do you see things heading in terms of registry research?
Yeah, first of all, we have to keep in mind that this registry, the BRIGHT Registry, was actually mandated by FDA. So this is a brand new drug that was approved in 2004. There was these six GI perforations in Herb Hurwitz trials. No one really knew exactly what kind of pattern of risk factors might predispose to these perforations. Then there was this strange side effect of hypertension. This is a very different side effect profile than what we're used to from a cytotoxic drug. So FDA actually mandated the introduction of registries, and rightfully so. You need to get more information in a more or less real-life setting. And this was true for the European agency as well as for America. So we have the BRIGHT and the First Beat database. And this is actually in line with a lot of things that happen in other fields of medicine. For instance, growth hormone treatment, like for small children, you know, that lack growth hormone, all these patients in America get funneled into a registry. And rightfully so, because you want to see what's exposure to growth hormones in early age, what does it do later on? I mean, 20 years, do we have high incidence of cancers, etc.? So we can learn from registries, even in non-randomized fashion. And there are certain situations where you never would like to do randomized clinical trials, like you would never kind of test the functionality of parachutes in a randomized session. You would never do that because you know what's going to happen. And there are certain fields of science where you only have observational data, like archaeology. I mean, we know dinosaurs exist not from randomized trials, but from retrospective digging. And so I don't want to kind of belittle the skepticism against observational studies, because I do see that there is a risk that these data can be used for marketing strategies. And I've seen these data actually placed in context which I wasn't quite comfortable with, so which kind of distracts from the actual scientific findings. And I would hope that the use of registries is something that can advance our knowledge about a drug, and actually has advanced our knowledge about a drug.
Malik?
Was there any relation between the degree of hypertension and proteinuria and response to bevacizumab?
Yeah, an interesting point. But there is some early data that came out of pancreatic cancers early. Heidi Kindler reported that about 3 years ago, that there was some 2 years ago increased response rate or longer progression-free survival with the use of bevacizumab in pancreatic cancer when hypertension was around. But, you know, bevacizumab really didn't do that much in pancreatic cancer. So the hypertension correlation is also difficult because we interfere because we use antihypertensives. And we have different thresholds for doing that. We should probably use it more readily. I mean, control blood pressure more readily than not, than just wait. So it's very difficult to tease that out. The ARIES registry, which is a new registry that has already enrolled about 2,000 patients with colon cancer first and second line therapy, and also now looks at lung cancer patients treated with bevacizumab first line, actually has one of the goals is to elucidate response versus hypertension issues in both diseases. So we'll have 4,000 patient data where blood pressure measurements and use of antihypertensive in the end going to be correlated with outcome.